Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to go ahead and get started. This panel is What the Church Can Offer Youth. And I am thrilled because we are going to be hearing from the former youth themselves, the recently former youth. Serving the youth in the church has been one of my passion projects. And I, as somebody who's served the youth, I'm always getting asked, but I love that we can just have these bright and brilliant voices who can speak for themselves and tell us exactly what we need to hear. So we're going to start with these wonderful speakers are all from the Young Mormon Feminists blog, which is required reading in my house, and I hope it is in yours too. We have Julia Jarrett, who is a lawyer and mother to an 18-month-old daughter. Emma Tillerstone is a participant in Young Mormon Feminists and will start her senior year of high school this fall, and that's not a typo. And then Tanisha Zandamella is a senior at BYU studying sociology and French. So we'll just continue down that line. And hopefully we will also be hearing from Marina Tierno Abe. I hope I didn't butcher that. And she's a Japanese Venezuelan Mormon feminist living in Utah. So hopefully she will be joining us in a minute. So I will turn the time over to our Young Mormon feminists.
Do these work? Do these work? Okay, for the sake of recording, you probably want to be mic'd. Okay, I'll go up here.
I'm a little bit shorter. As Teresa said, my name is Julia Jarrett, and I don't actually write for the blog. I am one of the hosts for the newly installed podcast for Young Mormon Feminists, which has been a lot of fun, and I hope that you haven't, if you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, I hope you give it a listen. Any suggestions, we're always open. So I know that the topic is about the youth of the church. I have construed that a little bit broadly because I am a little bit far away from being a youth. Also, a lot of the social research that has to do with young people in the church focuses less on the people under 18 and more on the people over 18. So a lot of my remarks are going to be focused on the millennial generation, of which I am a member, which is defined as ages 18 to 33 years old. And the reason why I do that is not just for selfish reasons, so that I can relate and speak from experience, but it's also because I find that a lot of the youth of the church, up until they're 18, are living with their parents. So many of the reasons that they would stay in the church or that what the church offers them has to relate to the relationships with their parents and their peers. I think once you get past 18, those reasons change a lot. And I find that those reasons are a lot more varied and a little bit more interesting from my perspective as, again, as a member of that age group. The question of why we have to have this conversation, why we're asking what the church has to offer youth, is a pretty broad and storied conversation, and would take far beyond what this panel has time for. But I'm going to briefly touch on that in my presentation. And keep in mind that this is a generation that has not yet invested their lives in the church. Most of us have not had major leadership callings. Most of us have not yet raised our children in the church. And if we have children, they're still quite young. Most of us have not married or entered a serious relationship with another member of the church. A lot of the ties that keep people older in the church or that the church has to offer are specific to a lot of those life experiences. So why we're having this discussion around youth and young adults is because we're just different. I also want to emphasize that this isn't a topic that is unique to Mormonism. Churches of all denominations and creeds are struggling with how to engage young people in their organizations and in their religions. Catholic Church is facing an exodus of young people, and a lot of this is based on some of the same social issues that the LDS Church has a conservative similar stance on. Today, I'm going to discuss first how this generation is different, second, what exactly we're looking for, from my perspective, again, this is all qualified. And then third, five things I think that this church offers our generation. I apologize, I don't have any slides for today. I had these 5 points, and there was one sentence on each of the slides, and then putting stock photos on it was both preposterous and time-consuming. So you get a look at my lovely face and the face of my lovely co-panelists, and hopefully that will keep you engaged. So first of all, how this generation is different. There are a lot of young people in the church, but keep in mind we are largely led by baby boomers and what is called the silent generation, which is age 68 and plus. Now, that's probably like 90% of our general authorities. Now, that's a made-up statistic. I don't know that for sure. You know, I'm just positing a guess. But the rest of the statistics are accurate. So just to demonstrate how the attitudes are different between the changes, between the generations, I want to put forth a case study based on viewpoints about same-sex marriage. So this is coming from a study coming from the Public Religion Research Institute that came out in February 2014 called A Shifting Landscape, A Decade of Change in American Attitudes About Same-Sex Marriage and LGBT Issues. So there are two categories. One is to demonstrate the generation gap, and one is to show that a lot of these attitudes really give people a basis for leaving religion in general. Today, 69% of millennials favor same-sex marriage, compared to 37% of the silent generation. Again, that's 68 plus. Now, this is not restricted to political views. I know that young people tend to skew more liberal, but of those, of the millennials who are Republicans, 50% favor same-sex marriage, a view shared by only 18% of Republicans in the silent generation. So you can see how much of a disparity there is in these opinions between the generations. Now, as how this serves as a basis for people leaving religion, among all Americans... Americans of all ages who left their childhood religion and are now religiously unaffiliated, one quarter say that negative teachings about or treatment of gay and lesbian people was a somewhat important or very important factor in their decision to disaffiliate. So that's 25%. Among millennials, that goes up to one-third. So one-third of people who've left their childhood religion said, look, this is a big issue. So it shows that there's not only a difference of opinion, but it shows that millennials are more willing to leave their church based on these issues. On reflecting on what this generation really needs, I came across an op-ed written by Rachel Held Evans, who's the author of a book called A Year of Biblical Womanhood. And she wrote an op-ed for CNN.com about young people in Christianity in general. And this article really resonated with me, so I'm going to read a portion of it. She says, "Having been advertised to our whole lives, we millennials have highly sensitive BS meters, and we're not easily impressed with consumerism or performances. In fact, I would argue that church as performance is just one more thing driving us away from the church, and evangelicalism in particular." So she's talking about this kind of rock band movement and church saying, well, if we put on rock bands, young people will like it more. Which I think is not only patronizing, but is not proved to be accurate. So then she goes on to talk about, instead of just merely revising marketing pitches, try looking at the content of the messages that the church is sending. So she says, what millennials really want from the church is not a change in style, but a change in substance. We want an end to the culture wars. We want a truce between science and faith. We want to be known for what we stand for, not what we're against. We want to ask questions that don't have predetermined answers. We want churches that emphasize an allegiance to the kingdom of God over an allegiance to a single political party or a single nation. We want our LGBT friends to feel truly welcome in our faith communities. We want to be challenged to live lives of holiness, not only when it comes to sex, but also when it comes to living simply, caring for the poor and oppressed, pursuing reconciliation, engaging in creation care, and becoming peacemakers. You can't hand us a latte and then go about business as usual and expect us to stick around. We're not leaving the church because we don't find the cool factor there. We're leaving the church because we don't find Jesus there. Like every generation before us and every generation after, deep down, we long for Jesus. And that really resonated with me because not only are many of these points that she goes through kind of applies to her church and kind of the mainstream Christianity, but I think it really resonates with Mormonism. So let's be clear. The youth, like the author above, don't particularly value slick advertising campaigns. We're not drawn in by having Brandon Flowers talk about why he's Mormon. We're also not brought in by social media presence. Elder Ballard being on Twitter, while interesting, is not going to keep our attention. especially the way they're going. I'd love to say they're not Twitter experts. An uber focus on lifestyle and policies over doctrine, such as holiness more than not having sex, holiness more than not dressing modestly, that's not going to keep us in this uber focus on lifestyle. A line in the sand constructs. We're not looking for line in the sand constructs, things that exclude other seekers and other followers of Christ. The youth of this church want to feel Jesus in our services. So that brings us to our topic, what this church can offer the youth. There are many who stay in the church who no longer believe in truth claims. So the church has to be more than just the one true church on earth. It has to be better than other organizations in providing and caring for spiritual and community needs. And I think that for many, this church can provide that place. Despite doubts and concerns and a societal trend to unbelief, the church can still hold an important place in people's lives. So I pinpoint five things, and this list is by no means exclusive, five things that the church has to offer you. The first one is the church can be a place to make a difference. I think that the millennial generation and the generation under the millennials are idealists. We want our lives to matter. We were raised with this idea that you do what you love and then success will follow. And sometimes that's not always true, but we still hold on to it. And I think that comes over to our activity in the church. If we have an opportunity where we feel like our voice is heard, like we feel like we can make a difference, I think that the church can fill that need. And it can fill that need in three areas. First is difference in people's lives. This church has a really unique structure, whether it has a good rep or not. But visiting teaching and home teaching is this construct within the church that has an opportunity for people to have an intimate relationship with another person, not intimate in a sexual way, intimate in an emotional way, with another person where you can really get to know them and you can really care for their needs. That's the whole idea, is this personal ministry. I don't see that in talking to my peers from other churches and other community groups, that same kind of structure program is not necessarily available all the time. And I think that can be really valuable, not just to the people being served, but to our generation who wants to serve and wants to make a difference in people's lives. Second, I think that we can make a difference in the church. The idea of effecting change in the church, I think, is one that certainly my parents never conceived of. I don't think they ever woke up in the morning and say, how can I make the church a better place today? Meaning church with big C, church writ large. Not just in your local congregation, but how can I affect change? How can I have a positive effect on big C church? We are in a different world. We have seen where people have made very real changes and very important strides towards change in the church. And the job is obviously not over. There is a lot to do, and I think that people in this generation see that and see that as an opportunity. I think they see it sometimes as extremely overwhelming. Sometimes it can feel futile. But I also think that with more voices out there, the more change we can affect. Mormonism, although it can sometimes feel big, is an exceptionally small community. And if you want to have your voice heard, you really can just put it out there with the internet, with blogs, with groups like Young Mormon Feminists, Feminist Mormon Housewives, Mormon stories. There's a lot of different groups online that and Sunstone where you can put in the effort and you can have your voice heard and see positive results. We also expect more of our institutions. I think we expect more transparency from our institutions. And so the church must adapt to our generation, or they're potentially going to lose it. But but importantly, the church won't change until the membership changes. I think that as opposed to not all of us are Kate Kelly and can, and you know, members of Ordained Women and can start, you know, campaigning on a large scale for wholesale church change. A lot of us don't want that or are too scared. But the church won't change until the membership changes, and I think that we can make that change on an individual level, one person at a time. And I see it happening. I see it happening in my family, my mother's attitude towards my participation in the Sunstone Conference, for one, was a shock to me that she was so positive when I've heard her say other comments about publications like Sunstone and Dialogue in the past. So people's minds are changing, even members of the Silent Generation. We can change how the world views Mormons. We don't have to have the perception of being anti-gay, of being anti-women. We can be the voice saying that, well, not all people think this. And we can make a change in that. Now, this wouldn't be a very productive conversation unless we talked about ways the church can improve. So I'm going to posit one way that the church can improve on helping us make a difference. And I think that's making a difference in the world. The Mormon church is exceptionally locally structured, and we're really focused on taking care of our own. You know, through a lot of those things, like visiting teaching, home teaching, the welfare program, it's all about taking care of our own. The church does not as often emphasize the importance of advocating for human rights and other social concerns. Same-sex marriage. What if we organized an action camp? What if the church put as much energy into organizing an action campaign advocating for non-discrimination laws against LGBT people, as it says it supports, as they did fighting against same-sex marriage? And I would argue that human rights in our country is just as moral, is just as a moral issue as the church says that same-sex marriage is. I think that this is an opportunity that the church can seize upon to tap in to this generation's willingness to make changes and have a place. We can also focus more on helping, the church can focus more on helping the poor in our communities, but outside of Mormonism. I think that this obviously varies, but once in my church tenure, I've gone to, through a church activity, I've actually gone to a homeless shelter or soup kitchen. And so that's once in my 29 years. I meet people in other congregations, and people outside of faith communities do it far more frequently. And I think that there's an opportunity for our church to engage in that. Okay, so that was my first point. The other ones aren't as long, I promise. My first point is that the church can offer us a place to make a difference. The second point is I think that the church can and needs to offer us a place of peace. Now, when I first was thinking about this, it felt a little bit contradictory to my first point, because oftentimes change can result in conflict, can result in feelings of otherness, and that's not peace. But I think that for a lot of people, the church at different points in their life can be a strong place of peace. And I think that's important in a world of 24/7 everything. So much of the church's regular just kind of structure encourages habits like scripture study and prayer, which, apart from the spiritual aspect, allows you to focus on yourself and allows this structured time of introspection that can improve your relationship with God, or it can improve through meditation your relationship with yourself. Journal writing also encourages this type of reflection, and I think that if it's emphasized about how this can be a place of peace, that can really resonate with some people. Now, the flip side, so ways to improve, is that oftentimes the church, apart from kind of our place to change, it can be so chaotic in what we're asked to do, just in the practical everyday things that we're asked to do. If you're in the Young Women's Program, you have weekly activities, you have weekly lessons, you're constantly calling people and emailing people. I mean, and that's just, one auxiliary. People who, have leadership positions in other organizations obviously have those similar demands. And that can really detract from your ability to find peace in your life and in your church activity. So I think that the church can improve on that. I don't know how, but it needs to, because we need to be able to have a place of solace. Okay, so my third point of what the church can offer youth, and again, youth is broadly, a foundation in religious education by which to interpret other constructs. So through that lens. If you were raised in the church, you're given this great kind of foundation of religious education that when it's not totally enmeshed in this Mormonism, you can really use it to understand other religions. I think that when we take that Mormon gloss off things, we actually do have a lot of great religious fundamentals, and we may not realize it until we go into other faith traditions more deeply. I think that this is a benefit, but the improvement is that I think we need, this wouldn't be a Young Mormon Feminist panel unless I mentioned the need to have more female voices in the church. The religious education that we have is largely male-centric. It's largely taught by males. I never had a female seminary teacher, with the exception of maybe local congregations like Sunday school teachers and young women's teachers. The church as a whole, we are largely taught by men. And this is a difference where, I think this is the exception to what I said earlier, where the way that a message is delivered is not as important to this generation. I think that when you hear something from, when you hear from a woman, I think that that changes the message. But more importantly, when women are making the message changes. And I think that's the key point that we can add to this religious education that we're engaging in. Fourth point, social life and community. I mean, the church is fantastic at having social life. It's structured around these small organizations so that you can get to know the people in your neighborhood. Just a quick story. When I moved to D.C., Washington, D.C., for the first time about 6 years ago, I moved into the basement of this woman, the basement of this woman's house, and she was very lovely and drove us around the whole neighborhood telling us about where everything was. Here's the grocery store, here's the coffee shop, and every time we passed a church, and she's like, well, there's the Lutheran church, there's the Episcopal church, there's the Catholic church, and she's like, so do you think you know where you're going? Like, do you know where you're going? I'm like, yeah. She's like, well, if you need help on churches. I'm like, well, we have a church. She's like, already? She was shocked that we would already have this community. And not only did I have a place to go on Sunday, but I had people help me move in. And these sound like very small things. And obviously it's not always perfect. But I think that the ability to have this built-in group of people is something that's really special about the church. Now, on the flip side of that, single sports, good and bad. But I think the important part is that we need to stop, so this is the way to improve, we need to stop age discriminating against young people who are not married. I solicited responses from the Young Mormon Feminist Facebook group on what things the church can offer people. And we said, one person said, quote, quit with the age discrimination for singles at age 31. It's arbitrary and capricious. I think he was a lawyer. It's arbitrary and capricious and no longer serves any purpose. Stop marginalizing older singles just because they hit 31 and haven't got married off yet. And I think that that is, I don't know where the church leadership is on this, because it's been an issue for so long. We need to emphasize that the people's value apart from their family construct. And sometimes this social life in this community fails miserably in that area. Okay, fifth, I know I'm out of time. The fifth point is habit development and refinement. I've been reading this book called The Power of Habit. I'm sure some of you have heard about it, by Charles Duhigg. And he talks about this habit cycle. So we have a cue, a routine, and a reward. So something triggers an action. We go through the routine that we usually go through in this hope of this reward. So we do these things because we're conditioned. And I think that the church offers so many ways for us to practice it and instills it in us from a very young age. For better or for worse, we have these habits in the church that are developed through this, but we can use that and harness that in our personal and professional lives to become more disciplined people. So we, through the youth programs, through the emphasis on daily scripture study and daily or multiple times daily prayer, the emphasis on this development of habits can really serve us well when we, in our personal and professional lives. So in summary, so the five things: place to make a difference, a place of peace, foundation in religious education, community, and habit development. This church is more than the church of our parents. It's more than the church of public relations and marketing. It's a church of everyday people like you and me, and it has so much to offer and even more potential. Thank you.
So when I was first asked to speak on this panel, the first memory, I guess, that came to mind was when I was home about a year ago. I'm 20, so I'm not that old, but I'm no longer in the Young Women's Program. And I was walking around my church building trying to find my dad, and I stumbled upon the young men and young women. They were having a combined meeting on Fifth Sunday. And my brother and sister, both in Young Men's and Young Women's. And so I kind of poked my head in and wanted to see what was going on. So the lesson was about trials and struggles that the youth were having. And rather than the people sitting down, the youth, talking about their struggles, it was a long-winded story from the state president about their struggles. And I was a little bit confused. I thought that it was a joke at first, but it wasn't. And I realized that, as I lingered, I realized that the supposed chosen generation was just sitting there listening to older people talk about what they think their struggles are. And the state president would ask, all right, what struggles do you guys have? And someone would raise their hand and explain something. And he turns around and he's writes on the board, okay, drugs, right. And someone else would say something, and he would be like, oh, necking and petting, okay, vow chastity, and write on the board. And none of that was even related to what the youth had said, and also, who knows what those things are. And so as I was thinking about this, Sunday school and young women's and meetings that I had been in when I was a youth, no one wanted to hear what you had to say. You go to the meetings, you sit there, they give you donuts afterwards, maybe, and no one listens to what you have to say as a youth. Your voice is kind of invalid. And that's how I felt, at least. And so, what can the church offer youth? Well, I think the easy answer for me is to just provide a place, a safe place, to listen and learn from youth experiences, but I couldn't make it that easy. I can't end my presentation here. So I'm going to talk specifically about a marginalized population in the LDS Church, which is youth of color, which I know about. So I've been a member my entire life. I've grown up, though, in predominantly white areas. I was born in Provo. I lived in Hawaii for a little, but most of my life I've lived in Vancouver, Washington area. And it's been interesting. My dad is black. He is from Mozambique, which is in southern Africa. And my mom is white. She grew up in Montana, in Washington, just all sorts of rural places. And my parents met at Ricks College, which is now BYU-Idaho, and back then it was a two-year college. They met there, they moved to Provo, they transferred to BYU, and they decided that they were going to get married. And this was 1990, where you think, or maybe you wouldn't, I don't know, you'd think that it wouldn't have been that big of a deal, but it was. My parents went to several different leaders who refused to marry them in Provo. So they actually ended up having to come up north and find someone that would let them get married in the temple. Not because of worthiness issues, because they refused to endorse a marriage that they believed was basically Satan's plan. So with that in mind, that's sort of where I grew up, is knowing that those are things that happen to my family, and in places that aren't, it wasn't just a one time, one person saying one thing. It was multiple people. And when my parents attended church as students at BYU, people refused to home teach them and visit teach them. And my parents always joked there was only one lady in their ward that was nice to them, and she was blind. So, and so I grew up in predominantly white areas, like I said before, and currently I live in Provo, so as white as you get, and I go to BYU. And when I started to attend BYU, you know, you fill out all your contact information, your personal information. I consider myself biracial, so I put white and black African American. However, BYU doesn't really want you to consider yourself biracial. I'm not really sure. They picked one for me, so I have a primary race, and that's black African American, presumably to raise statistics. That's my personal thought. But still, even with my number in the statistics, there are less than 1% of people at BYU who are black African American. So it is it's a lot of white people. And so as a youth, I recognized very quickly that I was an outsider. And it's interesting because my parents weren't, gender roles are not a thing in my household. My parents are very liberal, and so those things made us an outsider, but I knew the biggest thing that I knew growing up in the church that made me an outsider was you're biracial. And even at a young age, even at 7, I recognized that. I knew that I was different, and my parents and I talked about it, but it was something that bothered me a lot, because you go to church and you see people around you, the leaders, and none of them look like you, none of them have experienced the same things, and they don't understand. So as I was thinking about the topic of what can we offer the youth, and I'm, you know, focusing specifically on youth of color, I thought it's really important that we talk about privileges and what privileges white youth have in the church as opposed to youth of color. And I think so that's kind of what I want to go into a little bit. Before that, though, I want to say I'm not a race spokesperson. Sometimes when I talk about race, people assume that I'm speaking for everyone. I'm not speaking for everyone. The privileges are privileges that youth of color don't have, but I'm not everyone. I don't speak for all of the communities at all. And the second thing that I want to bring up is just that the stories and the privileges and the things that I'm going to talk about are not my crazy ward back home story. These are things that happen all over the United States and to youth of color. And so it's not one, you know, it's not one crazy young woman's leader that said something to me once that, you know, it's not just one person. And I think that that's important because we need to recognize that even sometimes I think that when we hear things that pertain to us being an ally, we want to say, no, I would never do that. That's not me. I would never say that. That's horrible. And maybe you wouldn't, but I think it's important before jumping to that and just blocking it out and saying, I would never do that. that I would never say that. No one I know would ever say that. To just think about the privileges and go from there. So like I said, youth of color do not have the same privileges that a white youth in the LDS church do. And I'm speaking specifically about the United States because that's what I knew about. I grew up here. The first privilege that I was thinking is that white youth don't face scrutinization as much as youth of color do. When I was growing up, I knew that if I did anything bad, everyone would know about it. And it wasn't a little bit of gossip. It was one time I wore sequin high heels to church, and I got called in the bishop's office because they said, you're not supposed to dress like a prostitute. So anything that you did that was maybe a little bit off, you got in trouble. My dad has been in trouble multiple times for wearing colored shirts to church. Other people do that. Nothing is said. And so that was something that my parents always told us, you don't do anything that would prove them right. So you have to be perfect. You have to make sure that you do everything right, because if you mess up, everyone knows about it and you're in the bishop's office. And that reflects poorly on the family. The second thing was activities at Mutual. This is maybe a little bit of a smaller thing, but it still really bothered me. I love hair, I love makeup, I love clothes. And we had this activity at Mutual. It was probably my second time. I was 12. I was really stoked because, you know, big kid stuff. And they had this hair and makeup activity, and I was so excited. I go to the hair and makeup activity, and they're doing French braids. My hair doesn't French braid. I can't French braid my hair. I don't know. I've tried once. It was horrible. You can't do that. And they had this makeup laid out. It was like 50 Shades of Beige. Like, I can't. And so it was really frustrating because I'm 12 and I realized I can't participate. I'm going to be there for an hour and a half and I have to be the awkward new person eating food because I can't be part of that activity and everyone else can. The third thing is the ability that white youth have to go to wards and temples and temple square without people assuming that you have converted to the church. So I grew up in the church. I've always been a part of the church. I went to temple square with my mother and her sister, who are both white, and my cousin, who's also white. So we're walking down temple square, and these sister missionaries approach us, and they look at my mom, and my mom explains, oh, this is my sister, and this is her daughter. And no one asked about me. And the sister missionary says, I am so glad that you brought someone to learn about the church today. And my mom freezes and says, that's my daughter. And they kind of were a little bit taken aback. There was like, how does that happen? Which is usually the response. So they think about it, and my mom has to explain, because that often happens at church activities. We have to explain, oh, my husband's black. Oh, okay, great. Okay. And then they walked away. The fourth thing is feeling like an outsider, and I mentioned that briefly. You go to church, you go to activities, large activities. I was at a dance festival once. There was thousands of people. And you're walking through the crowd with my sister, you know that you're different. And people are staring at you. It was my area. I knew some of the people, but people stare at you. And the same thing goes for BYU. There's a joke all the time that if you see someone who is black or biracial, you have to make a note of it, because that never happens. People always joke about being really excited when they see someone. And so you know that people are staring at you. You know that, and that's happening. Also, church movies, the new era, white youth get to see themselves represented all the time. When you get the new era, it is usually a smiling blonde girl or boy, and they look really happy. The only times that I think that I remember seeing someone in a seminary movie that was even somewhat close to my race, by that I mean any youth of color, was, I think it was a Nephite Lamanite movie. So, of course, the Lamanites were the people, those were the people that were most closely represented with me. And I just, that's hard when you think that those people, those are the only people that you get represented as. And then you can, if you're white, you can go and look and find examples of you other places. Being beautiful and the standard of beauty in the LDS Church, as well as dating, is something that is definitely a white privilege. You can find other people of your race. You can also, other people don't assume that you need to only date people of your race. There was, I think, two black boys in my stake, and everyone always wanted to set me up with them. I knew them pretty well, and I did not like them. I did not want to go on a date with them, and we were both very clear. All of us were very clear. We don't want to go out with each other. It's still, every time LDS prom came up, my young women's leaders, my bishop would nudge and say, you should definitely go out with Sadeo. He's your best bet just because we're in the same sort of racial category. And I think lastly, your testimony just never is good enough. And you have to continually prove that you are a member and that you are worthy to be at whatever activity it is. It's important that if you are a white person in the church, that you look at those privileges and acknowledge them before going about and seeing what resources we can offer youth of color. Because once we acknowledge those privileges, when we acknowledge privileges, then we can say, how can we help, instead of sort of just jumping in and being white savior and trying to help out. And it's important to think, when I went to church, I went to go escape the world, right? That's the point. You're supposed to have this break where you're escaping the bad things of the world. But I went to church and I faced the same microaggressions that I would anywhere else. It wasn't an escape. And that needs to be changed. So when I think about what the church can offer youth, I sort of excluded the leadership because realistically, I honestly don't think that there are any really great resources that the prophet has to offer as far as race goes. And I think that if there were something like that, it's just a mess. I just don't want to even think about that. So I focus on more what can members do in their congregations, in their wards, in their stakes, to make it safer for youth of color. And so what can the church offer youth? What can we offer in our congregation? I think that's the wording as far as my topic goes seems a little patronizing, because I don't want to say, what can white people offer youth of color in the church? It's not a gift to be if you're listening to youth of color, that's not some great gift that you're offering. That's what should be happening already. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's better to word that as, what do youth of color offer the church? And the voice of LDS youth of color are incredibly crucial because they're a part of the church. They're a large part of the church. And when their voices are silenced, this integral part of the church is stifled and no progress can be made toward inclusivity and diversity. And so how do we honor and respect those voices? We listen. That's the big thing. Everyone thinks that they're a good listener. I've met very few people who say, I'm a terrible listener. We all want to believe that we're good listeners. I have come to realize that maybe I'm not a good listener, and that's something that I'm trying to work on. But I think that we think that we listen. Listening means you're actually taking in what they have to say, not just hearing, taking in what they have to say, and not spitting back advice and telling them what to do. Audre Lorde talks about the hierarchy of oppression and says there is no hierarchy of oppression, and I agree with that completely. One thing that I do notice, though, as far as listening, is when I talk sometimes about race in the church, people come back and say, I get that. I totally get that. Because one time I was at church and someone said something to me because I was a woman. Now, those things are both oppression, and that happens in the church. But if you are white, you have never experienced racism. It is not the same thing. There's no hierarchy, but it's not the same thing. And to look at someone who is of color and say, I know exactly what that's like. You don't. That, unless you are, you don't know. It's important to let youth of color talk about their own experiences without judgment. Don't ask them to constantly break down their experiences. Especially the blacks in the priesthood lesson, every time I knew it was coming, I would just make sure that I was sick that day. Because everyone expects me to tell them how I feel and how the entire black community and biracial community and every other community feels about blacks in the priesthood. That's not their job. And also, don't expect youth of color to educate you. I think that that's a big thing, is expecting that, well, if you want me to know something, you have to teach me. Well, there's the internet, which is a great resource, and you need to provide a safe place for youth of color to talk, but not expect them to teach you everything. I truly do believe that change, especially in the church, can happen, but I don't necessarily think that, especially with change like this, it can come from the top. I don't think President Monson can make a statement and everything's going to get better. And so that's why I'm talking about specifically the membership and congregations. Change begins in our wards and our stakes. It begins in a Sunday school class. It begins in that mutual activity, that hair and makeup mutual activity. We can't expect white leaders to recognize our privilege. That's not a trickle-down effect. Someone else doesn't recognize their privilege, and then also you suddenly recognize your privilege. The voices of youth of color in the church are absolutely crucial. I've heard people claim that maybe there just aren't enough youth of color, but that is not true. We're just not providing a safe place for those voices to be heard. And as we move forward, it's important to think about how the LDS Church can become a more safe and inclusive place. And we need to make sure that youth of color can be heard. And I touched on some of the things that I think it's important for us to recognize before we move forward. If I have children, I want to send them to a church where they are welcomed and respected. I do not want to send them to the same church that I went to when I was a youth, where I was simply tolerated. Let's work towards that. Thank you.
I feel like I should start with this with, like, good evening, brothers and sisters, or something like that. So when I first started writing this, I thought about doing like a research paper kind of thing and finding all sorts of statistics about exactly who was leaving the church. But then I realized that high school was starting again in 3 weeks, and the last thing I needed to do with my life was another research paper. So instead, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories that will kind of help you get to know me better and know where I'm coming from with my final conclusion on what the church can do for youth. So I'm the only child of older parents. My dad had two children from his first marriage who were both over 20 when I was born, but I was lucky enough to have a dad who both had the experience of raising a daughter and also had the experience of being a single parent for 3 years. My mom was 40 when she had me, or my mom was 40 when she got married and 41 when she had me, and she had spent her life before that teaching high school English, so she already appreciated teenagers who liked to think critically. Because of this, I also grew up in a household where questions were important. My mother never met an issue she didn't want to see another side of, and as a professor, my dad answered every single question with, yes, but, and that but was typically followed by a lecture. And questions were always encouraged. Whether I wanted to know about finance, which my dad taught, and I very quickly learned I didn't actually want to know about, or whether I could have ice cream for dinner, the typical answer was, you totally can if you do research on it first. However, when I entered my freshman year of high school, I entered with very few questions about my religion or my life. As a 14-year-old, I had two personal progress awards, two honor bees, and 2 weeks of trek in Wyoming under my belt. On the first day of school, I wore my knee-length Mormon girl shorts to my first day of early morning seminary, where I played Come Come Ye Saints, the first of many hymns I would play as my seminary class pianist that year. I walked into high school with my schedule full of honors classes, my phone full of text messages from friends trying to coordinate our schedule, and my heart full of blessing my dad had given me on the first day of school. My life looked exactly like what the perfect Mormon girl life was supposed to look like. Or at least it did, until that October when one of my best friends told me she was pregnant. She was 15, and I had known her since she was 7. I had knelt by the font at her baptism to get the best view possible, and had sat by her in church most Sundays since. She was my Maya Maids class president. Her boyfriend was in my seminary class. The only thing I could think to do, as her friend, when she told me that she was pregnant, was give her a hug and promise that I would be with her through the whole thing, except for possibly the last few hours, because I was not going to be in a birthing room with her because I was 14 and wasn't interested. Other than that minor reservation, I felt like I was being a good supportive friend. I couldn't predict how rare that reaction would be. I watched over the next few months as almost all of her friends told her they didn't want anything to do with her anymore. Most of the time, her friends would cite the For the Strength of Youth, Choose Good Friends Who Share Your Values section, which I have come to hate. I saw this demonstrated most clearly when I tried to go to Mutual with my friend one time in December. At this point, she was showing, and word had gotten around our ward. On that night at Mutual, before we could go into the room where the youth always met, my young woman's president came out into the hallway and told my friend that she was no longer allowed to attend Mutual because of the influence she might have on the other girls. I remember leaving Mutual with my friend and sitting in the snow, because of course it was snowing, outside while the church was waiting, outside the church while waiting for my mom to pick us up. I also threw the same friend a baby shower a couple of months later. It was supposed to be primarily a ward shower, so I invited all 23 of the young women and the 9 young women's leaders, 32 people total. Of 23 young women who could have come, I was the only one there. And of 9 leaders who were invited, only 2 showed up. One of those leaders proved to be infinitely important during another event of my freshman year that happened just after Christmas break. That January, my cousin was raped by a stranger at gunpoint in her home. That day changed my family and changed me forever. I spent the rest of my freshman year checking email and constantly looking for developments in her case. From the very beginning, my cousin insisted that she would prosecute her rapist and do everything she could to put him behind bars. In her trial, she told him that he had duct-taped her mouth and silenced her once, but she would never be silenced again. This process of my cousin's trial happened to be happening at the same time that Elizabeth Smart started talking about rape culture in the Mormon Church. The idea of my cousin, who I thought of only as brave and powerful and incredibly important in my life, as a licked cupcake or a chewed piece of gum, was heartbreaking. Suddenly, the church I had spent my childhood loving and the Young Ones program that I invested so much time and energy and a lot of effort buying me like shorts into lacked any of the answers to the questions that I was asking. For the first time in my life, some of the things I was hearing at church seemed simply and inherently wrong. I was lucky enough to have both my parents and that one young woman's leader, who happened to be Donna Kelly, Kate Kelly's mother, because at least in this one aspect, I am incredibly lucky. And Donna Kelly works with rape victims and their families every day, so she was able to be infinitely sensitive to what my family and I were going through. And I was able to go to her, or at least hold my hand during the young woman's lessons that were especially hard, like whenever anyone brought cupcakes into her room. I quickly learned to run away, but it was still bad. Donna Kelly had showed my friend true Christ-like love when she was ostracized from our ward, and she showed me true compassion and loyalty when she refused to teach lessons that included any cupcakes or pieces of gum. I was also lucky to have my parents at this time. Their philosophy of entertaining all my questions held true, and every doubt that I had about the Young Women's Program and the messages I was receiving at church was addressed. The best answer my parents gave me came on my 15th birthday. My mom, being the super awesome person that she is, gave me Joanna Brooks's A Book of Mormon Girl. I remember reading it all in one day, actually during church because I had stopped paying attention, and crying because I had finally come up with a word that described years of experiences. I found a word for my mother, who was a former Relief Society General Board member who believed that the Relief Society was a kingdom of priests, and raised me to be proud of my brain, and to ask questions, and to come up with answers that rang true to me. A word for Donna Kelly and the other few leaders who were willing to accept the young women they were in charge of as they came. A word for the people who stood by my friend, understanding that Christ-like love is infinitely more important than a line printed in a pamphlet in Salt Lake. A word for my cousin who was brave and strong and never silent. And a word for me and my questions and the love of the gospel that seemed to be farther and farther from the institution every day. I had found the term Mormon feminist. That was 2 years ago, and even more dramatic changes had happened since then. In June, I found a Let Women Pray letter writing campaign. And in July, young Mormon feminists found me. I was suddenly in a community where the amazing Mormon feminists around me were numbered by the hundreds, and not 3. My hatred of cupcakes and gum was shared, and my apparently radical view that all people were equal was held by those around me. The online feminist community became a source for answers, and a source for more questions. I was suddenly delving into issues of Mormon history and seeking answers to harder and harder questions. It was through seeking these answers that I ended up wearing pants to church for the first, but not last time in December. And on March 17th, I put up a profile on Ordained Women. This year, I will be a senior in high school. I will walk into this year the top of my class, but I will not be playing piano in seminary, as I am no longer allowed to hold a calling in church. And I will not be taking classes at BYU as I had planned, because I have been denied an ecclesiastical endorsement, because my bishop believes I am affiliated with an apostate organization. And while I have given a talk, while I had given a talk in sacrament meeting twice a year since I was 3, I have not spoken in sacrament meetings since I came out as a Mormon feminist, which makes me even more grateful for the super awesome opportunity to speak at Sunstone. Thanks.
Yeah, girl.
But the freshman I once was is still important to me. Over the last 2 years, I may have become disillusioned with the Young Women's Program and Cupcakes and Gum, but I still love singing Come Come Ye Saints, even though I can now honestly say I identify more with toil than joy as I wend my way. But this is still my church. It is my culture. It is my belief. And I will not allow anyone to take that away from me. The reason I stay, despite all of the questions and hardship that I've gone through on behalf of my membership in this church, is that I want to stay. And even after all of this, if I want to stay, there must be something somewhere worth staying for. The real point of this is that my story is not unique. I frequently hear parents say that they became feminists because of their daughters. But I am the daughter. I'm the child of older parents, so I might be older than a lot of the other daughters. But the next generation of church members is full of daughters and sons born with the makings of a Mormon feminist, the bravery to love, to learn, and to never be silent when an issue is this important. So, now you've all heard about my freshman year, but I want to tell you a different story, the story of what my freshman year could have been. When my friend told me she was pregnant, I gave her a hug, and so did the 23 other girls in my ward. They all came to her shower, and no one ever set out in the snow. In fact, my leaders were willing to help my friend learn basic parenting skills as mutual activities. My Young Women's president made my friend a quilt, and my Maya Maid's advisor gave her the cutest pink onesie I have ever seen. My friend was never ostracized, but was able to keep sitting by me in church and being a part of our community. When my cousin was raped, church became a safe place, a place where pain was assuaged because of the love of Christ. And I was given love, not lectures on cupcakes. I never had to doubt the atonement because it was never forgotten in lessons about how important virtue is, because my leaders knew there was something more important, love and acceptance and comforting those who are faint. Instead of doubt, I was given prayers. Instead of holding just Donna Kelly's hand, my leaders and friends all held my hand as I suffered with my cousin and rejoiced in her victory. When I had questions, I never had to hide them. I asked about my role as a woman, my heavenly mother, and my doubts about the church in seminary, Sunday school, and Young Women's, and never had to fear being the topic of a ward council meeting. My religion remembered that it came from a teenager's questions and did not deny mine. I was encouraged to seek out my own answers. I did not have to find FMH or YMF because my leaders, my ward, my bishop, and my conference ensign all told me that questions were okay, even if the answers didn't always fit nicely in a church manual. I found a haven of love and acceptance, a true community of Christ, and never had to fear being punished for honestly searching. My ward was a sanctuary in a time of hardship, not a war zone. These two stories are very different, but my hope is that someday the second story is the only one that Young Women will have to tell. For a long time now, the church has been able to push a lot of issues under the rug and just not talk about them. But as my story shows, these issues are becoming a reality for more and more youth in the church today. My story is not unique. Very few people, if anyone at all, are going to fit that picture-perfect Mormon girl mode past picture-perfect Mormon girl mold. I cannot say that without a straight face anymore. Just can't. Past the age of 14. Whether it's a pregnant friend, a cousin, or something even more common like divorced parents, a sibling who has left the church, or a gay uncle, reality is causing more questions to become more important to more people. And unlike the church 20 years ago, this generation is going to be able to find answers, whether they come from the church or not. Anyone who has access to Google, which is essentially everyone, will be able to see some scary facts about our religion that were hard to find in our parents' day. If Sunday school and seminary and Young Women don't start not only allowing questions, but being a place where questions are answered, they will continue to become less and less relevant in the lives of the youth of the church. I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that the church could eventually become a community of Christ, like it was in the second story. I hope it can remember that questions are a fundamental part of our faith and that Christ didn't hang out with other perfect people because he was the only perfect one. Instead, Christ accepted the lepers and the adulterous and the Samaritans. His disciples were fishermen, and he spent his time healing those who were sick. And he taught a gospel of perfect love and created a community where the only qualification for being there was wanting to be. I believe in having a community of Christ in Mormonism. I believe that having a community of Christ in Mormonism is entirely possible. I am a Mormon feminist because I believe in equality and acceptance, but I am a feminist because I am a Mormon and I believe in the second story. I believe in loving heavenly parents who show divine partnership and equality. I believe in asking questions and dedicating myself to the answers I receive. I believe in the eternal potential of every human being to grow. And I believe that this church has the potential to exemplify these values, and these values of searching, of loving, and of and of accepting are what this church really has to offer the youth. Thank you.
Does this work, by the way?
I don't think it does.
It doesn't?
Okay.
Hi, everyone. Is this too loud? Is this good? Yes? I was going to sit down because I really kind of need to pee, but that's okay. I'll dance up here and when we'll talk, it'll all be good. I walked in a little late, so I feel a little bad, but my name's Marina Tejerino, and I'm going to talk. First of all, I'm just going to kind of talk about myself because this is kind of the space where we get to do that for once, and I feel like, why not? You know, I feel really good about that, so... To start, I grew up LDS, for the most part. My family kind of went to church and then, like, didn't go to church, and it was kind of just back and forth the whole time I was growing up. I was born in Japan, and I grew up between Japan and different places in the United States, back and forth as well. So I feel like my experience in a lot of ways... of course, living here feels really unique, but I'm sure there's a lot of kids like me out there, you know, international families, and so I feel like my perspective is interesting as far as, like, a take on what the church can offer youth today. So, so first of all, when my family first moved to Utah, it was about, I think, probably about 7 or 8 years ago. In between them, I also still lived in Japan for a couple years, but... Man, we had such a culture shock coming here. Like, that was insane. So my mom is Japanese, my dad's Venezuelan. And just living for me and my family was a culture shock anyway. Because, like, my mom and dad, like, they never got along. Like, they finally got divorced, and it was, like, the best thing that could have ever happened. Because they were not meant for each other. Not to say, you know, because they were Japanese and Venezuelan, but they were just such different people. So I'm very... Culture shock is a term that I use very often and with a lot of feeling. Because that is something I'm so familiar with. So culture shock in Utah. My family moved to Linden. Of all places. My dad got offered a job as a professor at either BYU Hawaii or BYU Utah, and he decided to choose Utah, and I was so pissed at him. Like, I'm still pissed at him. I wish I grew up in Hawaii. That would have been so cool. But in many ways, I'm very grateful for my experience. Growing up LDS in Japan and in different places in California specifically, I was always surrounded by people like me. I'm really grateful for the presentation just given on race, actually, because this is something I absolutely identify with, and these experiences that Tanisha was just explaining are very relevant. They're very common. But as soon as I moved to Utah, my family, my family's still in this ward in Linden, but very, very much, I think for the first couple years, we were the only non-white family, actually. I'm pretty comfortable saying that. And that was very strange for me. It was very surreal. And I was about 12 years old when I first moved here, so I was pretty young. I didn't have words to describe what the things I was going through were. I didn't know what the word sexism was. I didn't know what the word racism was. I mean, I've heard them before, but I just didn't, like, it never occurred to me, you know, until I moved here. So there were a lot of wonderful things about this ward, but... I had a lot of really crazy experiences, and instead of talking about all of them, I'm going to talk about one specific one. I went to Oak Canyon Junior High for a couple years in between moving to Japan, and I had a very horrible experience that I wouldn't wish on anyone, but I, you know, since then have found that this is, if common is the wrong word to use, I'm sorry, but if this seems to be a very prevalent kind of problem in all of its scale. But one day I was going to seminary, because that's what you do. That's what you do here, you know, after, like, my art class or something. And after seminary was over, I was still in this building. And I don't know what I was doing. It was after school hours. It was after class. I was just kind of hanging out there, and I was about to meet my friend Jesse outside, this friend of mine. And I realized at one point, like, I was all alone in this seminary building. It was completely empty, or so I thought. So I was like, all right, I think it's time for me to leave. And I start walking towards the front door, and one of my seminary teachers this tall, like, I don't remember his name, this tall, just white, bald dude, you know, which is kind of like my stereotype of seminary teachers for some reason. that's all I remember about them. He starts walking towards me, and we didn't exchange any words during any of this, but, and it happened so fast, but he kind of grabbed me, and I was kind of like in this corner of the building, still indoors. I didn't know what was going on, you know, I was just a kid. But he, this is the creepiest part, but he started like tickling me, or like trying to. He started like kind of touching and tickling me. And I was laughing because what do you do when someone, I mean, it's not, no one actually enjoys being tickled, but like you just can't help it. So it was a weird response, and I was at the same time very afraid and very confused. And I don't know how long it happened. Like, I'm sure it went on for a few minutes, but I started to struggle. I started to try to, you know, get away from this man, obviously, very uncomfortable, very creepy. And he just let me go at some point. Anyway, this is a experience that I have, like, brought up a lot because up until that point, I had never really, like, had any second thoughts about authority or what it means to have, like, power dynamics and what it means to be taken advantage of by someone that not only is, you know, doing something bad, but they actually have other modes of power over you. I had no idea what that meant. So I was 12 years old, and then this happened to me. And I was fine, you know, for all intents and purposes, nothing, like, happened. But that assault changed my life forever. From that moment, I kind of awoke to the fact that there are certain things that are missing within the sphere of my church and seminary and that sort of thing. It just, you know, there's a lot more that happened. I'm not going to talk about all of it, but in the end, this man was protected, and I was not. And my individual experience is obviously unique and different from every other experience, but this is something that I think happens a lot on a lot of different scales. So from that moment on, I actually kind of awoke to the fact that, like, the only option I had was to not go to seminary. You know, instead of someone helping me to be comfortable or someone going after this guy because he should have obviously known better when I didn't, all my only option was just to not go. So I never graduated from seminary. And my response to anyone who asked, which I got asked a lot, like, you graduated from seminary, right? Like, if you want to go to BYU, like, you got to have these things, you know, and I would just say no. And the only possible, you know, response that these people seem to have is like, oh, like, did you do something bad, you know? So that was an uncomfortable thing. I'm going to move on. So that was one moment where I kind of had a reality check. I'm going to talk a little bit more about ordained women now. In my life, I'm skipping over a lot of different things, obviously, but one thing that I keep coming back to is that while I had this experience and living in Linden, Utah, with my Japanese Venezuelan family, there were a lot of things about race and sex and class that had never occurred to me, and there were no words. I didn't have the language to describe it. I didn't have anyone on my side as an advocate for any of these scenarios. And I think that if we're going to talk about what the church can do better for its youth, youth, you know, is a very general term, but youth seems to kind of, like, invoke in me, at least, you know, a sense of innocence or naivete or whatever you want to call it. Like, we don't really know the world yet, you know. We need people and we need actual spaces. We need actual structures and conversations that are going to help us, and not just take for granted that you're part of this beautiful church and that the gospel is true and you'll be protected if you do the good things. Like, stuff happens, you know, and we need actual things to help us in these situations. I'd like to talk really quickly about community. As far as the church goes, I think several of you also mentioned this too, but there's something really cool about the LDS Church in that you can go pretty much anywhere in this world and find, like, a local branch or, like, bishop or something, and, like, you immediately have friends, you have a community. And that's pretty rare, and that's pretty cool, and that's something that has saved my family several times. And the church has done many great things for my family in particular, especially monetarily. And the church is capable of some pretty amazing things, so I don't want to come off as someone that just, like, you know, because of my experience or whatever, that the church just sucks, but because I don't feel that way at all. But I think because the church has this overarching just community all over the world, I think that there's a lot of things they can do to actually, like I said, have conversations about sexuality, have conversations about race and consent, that go further than just, you know, everyone's equal and we're all children of God and we're past these issues and we just need to love our neighbors, because that stuff is beautiful, but, you know, when it comes down to it, there's kids that are lacking some resources, serious places to feel safe. And the reason why I want to talk about ordained women is because ordained women changed my life. Like, that was the first time in the church that I found a community that got me, you know? Like, we were all unique, and that was what was so, so cool about it, but I actually had a community that had religious ties where I could talk about whatever I wanted. And I did not feel the threat of being punished or disciplined for having questions. Because I think one of you said that one of your parents or something, like, really encouraged questions. My parents encouraged questions. My dad wanted me to ask about everything all the time, and he was always comfortable, if he didn't know the answer, to say, "I don't know." He did not try to make up some excuse or something. He always said, "I don't know." And that's, I think that's very valuable. So, let's see. Really quickly, when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, it happened during a time where, you know, I had been falling out of the church and then not going to church and coming back to church and just being so confused, like, what is my place in all of this, you know? And then, again, the Ordained Women Movement just gave me, someone like me, a place to just feel comfortable for once. I mean, seriously, like, that ward in Linden makes me and my family feel so uncomfortable sometimes. There are some great people there, but I think it's unbelievable. Honestly, I think it's unbelievable sometimes. And when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, I just felt so hurt and so shocked. Obviously, it was her that is getting the discipline, but, I mean, what are people like me supposed to take from that? I mean, like, now we know for sure that we have, like, this kind of community called Ordained Women or Young Women Feminists or whatever we want to call it that will accept us, but, like, what about the mainstream? And I think that's really, I mean, to me, obviously that's sad, but I think that should be sad for a lot more people than just me and people like me, because there are some pretty valuable voices that we're missing out on here. So, and yeah, one really quick last point too. I don't know how much time I have or anything, but the leadership in this church, I know that Kate Kelly was excommunicated and, like, all of that, you know, stuff, the court and everything happened, you know, locally. But I feel like all of us have a responsibility as just by virtue of existing in a community and in a society to stand up for each other. And I think that the more authority you have, whether it's the priesthood or, like, actual leadership positions, I think the more authority you have, the more accountable you are. I think that the fact, this is purely my opinion, but the fact that my leaders, my, you know, I'm talking, like, higher up, I'm talking, like, 12, you know, the 70, those people, no, none of those people stood up for her, and that really, really sucks. Like, that seriously sucks. Like, I sustain them, right, as my leaders, and they're my protectors, and they are the mouthpiece of God, and I'm just spitting out things that I've heard, you know, in this ward, but just, you know, They didn't, no one stood up for her. No one actually put a stop to that. And in a lot of ways, I think I'm perfectly justified in losing some of my faith in my leadership. So that's a very sad thing. And I don't want to, like, just make this all sad and everything. I'm just trying to be honest here. But really quickly, I'm jumping around quite a bit. But one of my last points, too, I think that one of the cool things about ordained women, and this is not, like, a huge conversation, but I really love, even just on the Facebook group, a lot of people lately have been talking about how girls have been taught to, like, apologize. Like, we apologize for everything we do. Like, oh, sorry, like, I just apologize for taking up too much time. Like, this is my time to talk. Why am I apologizing? You know what I mean? Like, y'all are supposed to sit here and shut up and listen to me for as long as I want to talk. Like, I'm not going to apologize for that, but I did. I just apologize. apologize. That's messed up, you know. We should not apologize for our existence. We should not apologize for having opinions and ideas. I think that those are very different, and I think they're both very, very important. So I don't want to apologize for sitting here and, like, talking about my feelings, because I think they're valid, and I think that I'm not the only person that feels this way. And I do want to, like, obviously kind of, like, give a sort of disclaimer. I'm not going to church right now. I have not attended meetings in, like, I don't know, like, a year. I haven't held callings. I don't visit teach. My own mother asks me, actually, very frequently, you know, why do you care so much? You're not in the church. If you get the priesthood tomorrow, are you going to go back? You know, and she's saying that from a good place, but what I have had to tell her over and over is, like, you know what? It doesn't matter to me whether I want the priesthood or not, because I know that some women do. And I think that their, like, reasons are legitimate, and if they want it, they should be able to have it. And it doesn't matter that I'm not going to... I mean, if I get the priesthood tomorrow, I don't think I will go back to church. But that has nothing to do with the priesthood. That has everything to do with my culture around here. Right? This is not my culture. This is not my culture. The culture around here that I've been thrown into. And that's my personal decision. But I think that that attitude of there is just one certain way to be Mormon is the most... If there's something in the church that we need to change that can help our youth the most, we need to stop acting like there's only one way to be Mormon. There's only one way to go to church, and there's only one way to exist and take up space. And actually, my dear friend Natalie here, one time I was standing in line somewhere, I don't know what I was doing, at a shop or something, and someone, you know, behind me was ready to order, and I was like, oh, sorry, like, you can go ahead. And she's like, no, girl, you're allowed to take up space. You're allowed to take up space. And that, like, blew my mind. Like, I still think about that. Like, it changed my life because, like, no one told me that I'm allowed to take up space. Like, I'm allowed to actually sit here and do this, regardless of whether there's, like, a million people in front of me or just, like, one. Like, I'm allowed to take up space. And I think that we need to teach young girls and young men, but I mean, let's be honest, like, they already know how to think they're allowed to take up space. We need to teach everyone that it's okay for us to be here and not to apologize for things. So, you know, I only have this short presentation time, but and there's a lot of things I would want to say. But so just for this last bit, so in the vein of not apologizing, I wrote a song before Kate Kelly was excommunicated. And again, it was during a time when I was feeling very optimistic. I was feeling very empowered. I don't feel like I don't feel that way anymore. I do feel very sad and kind of downtrodden, and I'm honestly not sure what I'm going to do with the church in my life anymore. I still need to think about that. But Kate Kelly was, for the first time in my life, a role model that I had in the church. Like, I'd never had a role model in the church, you know. So, really quickly, I'm actually just going to sing this for you guys. And this is how it's going to go down. Let's see. Really quick. Sorry, this is funny. Take a ride with my future soulmate. Gotta hurry, don't wanna be late. My music's loud, the beat is great. I got a fantasy deadline to make. I got a society on the line, yelling kind of something to me at the same time, telling me you don't know how to rhyme, and out here we don't like that vibe yet. Here I am, take that as a sign. If you don't like it, well, that's just fine. Fresh light in sight, first of my kind. Japanese bellas roll with the style, it's all mine. I'm making musically progressive and obsessive, disorderly fashion with the passion, action. See, people don't know whether to fight or flee. Well, if it were up to me, all I take is an MP3 to make you see what it's like to be truly free. It don't matter what you say to me, ha, cause I'm in the zone. Life is easy when the care is gone. I got the speakers loud, beat is on. I'm dancing so hard like I'm all alone. Stop looking so pissed. Did you think girls like me didn't exist? Following the norm is overrated. Proud to be loud and opinionated.
power to the people, and I won't stop until I'm equal, and there's others like me, like there will spit it. Progress never ever really had a limit. If it does, I'm really wasting your time. Should've sat down, should've waited in line, but being silent ain't living. Choose the right ordained women. Yeah, I said it. Now everybody look around like who said it. So uncomfortable with the thought so radical. Free your mind, that's magical. Get that into your head, it's so critical. That's accomplishment, you did it. Almost there to the top, can you feel it, feel it? Choose to be what you wanna be. If you wanna know how, then sneak a peek. Freedom doesn't have to be a mystery. Baby, you don't know what you do to me. You've got what it takes, you are the key, ha. Let me hold you down. You'll be safe underneath my sound. Orbit Pluto when you come around. Orbit Pluto when you come around. Thank you.
You guys, I have a grin on my face. It's too big. That was unbelievable. And I just want to say, when I was growing up, I got heat because I sang gospel and blues instead of Janis Cat Perry. Oh, so I can't imagine if you busted that out in Sacramento.
We need to change the hymn book. More hip hop, please.
We have a few minutes. If anybody has questions for our illustrious bloggers, jump up to the mic.
And if it's being recorded,
so you want to ask them.
This is like testimony meeting.
I'm just waiting. Maybe if we look at them grumpily like a bishop, they'll come up.
My question isn't for like anyone in particular, so if anyone wants to answer, all of you. But I feel like there's a lot of focus on how to like build men up in the community and boys, and lots of like steps for priesthood or leadership or whatever, and they have a lot of focus on like a pathway, and I'm wondering how you would change it for youth or even like young adults. For women, what would you see? How can we do it together within like a structural change? What could be different to make it a more clear pathway and ways to kind of help build self-esteem and kind of self-worth rather than just kind of, I don't know, for me as a youth, maybe I'll say it this way, for me I always felt like the boys had something going on and they knew, and then we kind of like, I was just kind of waiting to go to college and get married, and I never felt like I had a lot. So how would you see that differently? How would you try to kind of foster that for women?
You can pass this down. I'll pass it along.
Okay, cool.
But I think that the church does create a pathway for women, and unfortunately it's the same pathway for every single woman, and you kind of described it, where you go and you get married and you have kids, and that's a very valid path, but it's not the path for everyone. And so I think that we need to focus. So President Hinckley talked about women having education, and I think that that's been interpreted as this backstop for women to have education, because what happens if your husband dies or you get divorced or for some reason your husband is not earning the money for you? And I think that that needs to be flipped on its head, of course, and it's more about education for a education's is valuable all on its own. It doesn't have to be for a career, or it doesn't have to be in case you're not supported by someone else. And B, education for a career for women. And I think that the Young Women's Program is really, the structure of it is in place to set up for that. We just need to change it. I mean, the structure is set up, we are developing skills, we're setting goals, and kind of what we talked about, like developing these habits that can make us successful in other pathways, but the things beneath that are not set up for that. So I think that, you know, a revision of the personal progress manual would be in order. And then secondly is that men are placed in positions of leadership, obviously very young. You know, men, and while women have opportunities, we are capped. And I think that that needs to change. And there are many methods that that can change, whether it's opening callings to be on the priesthood or ordaining women. But I think that both of those things could help.
Okay. So the first thing I want to say with this is that there definitely is like kind of a path set up for women, but it goes along the lines of my young woman's talking about an MRS degree, and not saying it ironically. But
what is that?
Oh, MRS, like Mrs., you go to college to get married, and that's the purpose of going to college. Like the BYU sophomore marriage plan. Yeah, it's bad. And it's been mentioned in Young Women's like a valid plan, which isn't great. Don't go to college to get married. It's too expensive.
There are cheaper ways to do it.
Honestly. But like the real thing is that the church does set up a path for women. It goes along the lines of go to college for a couple of years, get married to a returned missionary in the temple, and have a bunch of kids, and then do something. But that isn't a plan, especially not for girls who really, really like plans. And I love plans. The people who I brought with me today will tell you that we got here an hour early because of a flawed plan. Like, I mentioned that I did personal progress 2 times. It's because I was desperately searching for any structure in the young women's system. And like you mentioned, personal progress has all sorts of flaws, like, you know, virtue being a value, and a lot of things being the idea of, like, let's sow for 10 hours because that will help us develop our relationship with Heavenly Father. But people are searching for that structure, and I think the best way to give us that structure is give us somewhere to be going. Like, give Laurel's president something to actually do with their life instead of occasionally standing up to say a theme. Or give young women's leaders the power to actually do something with their girls. Like, I would love to go on a camp out. I actually wouldn't. I hate camping. But I'd love Laurel's leaders to be able to do something like, let's plan a camp out. Or give a Relief Society actual power and award. Let a Relief Society president come to PEC. Give women an actual voice, and suddenly there will be a structure that girls can work within.
So I feel that the way that I was taught, at least, was you sit quietly, you want to be humble and sweet and nice. That was not anything that I was necessarily very good at. I tried really hard, and I did succeed for a little bit, but I think that I've worked in Young Women's for a little bit, and my mom was an Activity Days leader, and so I've also been in Activity Days. And one of the things I think that's really important to kind of making a plan that isn't this, you know, get married, have kids, I think it's sort of letting that whole idea of you need to be nice and sit here and not get really excited about things, because the times in my life, at least, that I've gotten really passionate about things and really excited about things are the times when I got things done. And so I think that once, and I remember once my mom had this activity for the Activity of Girls, and she's like, what are you guys interested in? And everyone was like, I don't know, just like sewing and. And it was like, not that they weren't interested in those things. And she's like, okay, well then, like, let's get excited about it. And once people started getting excited about it, then they were like, oh, I could, like, knit something for this cause. Or I can knit something for my brother. Or, you know, people who were interested in cooking, they got really excited about it. And so I think that that's sort of where, when you're trying to make a plan, people need to kind of get excited about it. And so instead of this sort of drudgery of, like, you have to do these things.
I'm going to give, like, my dad's answer and be like, I don't know. Like, I'm not really sure what that would look like. It reminds me of when I was taking Philosophical Issues in Feminism at UVU. We read a Margaret Toscano piece when she was talking about, like, I'm not completely sure if she was giving a plan or if she was just kind of envisioning what a new church structure would look like. And she kind of points out, you know, if we're going to make these specific changes, for example, if women were to have the priesthood, I'm just using this as a great example, of course, but if the women were to have the priesthood and were able to hold all the leadership positions that men currently hold, what would that look like? I mean, do we just add them? I mean, do, like, couples become bishops together? Do stake presidents become, like, you know what I mean, like, partnerships? Or, like, do we need to, like, overthrow this entire system and just completely start from, like, rock bottom? I'm kind of like a hardcore socialist, so I would probably go for that one anyway. So, like, I'm not really sure what that would look like, but I think and this is probably not a very good response to your question, but all I know is it's not working right now. You know what I mean? Like, whatever we have right now is not working. It's not working for the best of the members, and it is oppressing tons of people, and you don't have to be aware of that to know that's a fact. It's a fact you can have, you know? So I think that there has to be some sort of huge change in order for us to, like, actually become better. And if the church, you know, continues to say that they're a church that advocates goodness and progress, you know, the church should progress as well, and I think some radical changes need to happen. I just don't know what that would look like.
We are out of time, so thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking our panelists.